I'd like to start off with some announcements. For those of you who plan ahead, you might make a note that on April the 10th, the week after Easter, there will be a special lecture by, as you see, by Mr. James Fallows. At the moment, we don't have a title, but we may have that later on in the spring. I may alert you that after the meeting, there will be free cookies and coffee in the lobby after the lecture, and therefore an opportunity to talk to the speaker and meet other members of the audience. At the end of the evening, down in front, we will be handing out free tickets to the Jane Coop Chopin concert in the Chan Center on March the 20th. In case some of you aren't aware, she's a faculty member and she will be playing the piano. Free tickets will be available here this evening, but because of the high demand for these tickets, we have to limit the number to 2 tickets per person or family. For those who need to pick them up elsewhere, they're available at the UBC bookstore, the Chan Center box office, and the Magic Flute record store on West 4th. It is the custom at this time to issue an appeal. And those of you who realize the merit of these Saturday night lectures and haven't committed, this is your chance. On the way out, there will be ladies out there who will be delighted to receive your membership and your money. We are very lucky this evening to have an interesting speaker from our own campus. And I can assure you, it's going to be a speaker. He's not going to read, he's going to speak, which is my favorite way of getting a lecture. I'd like to pay a tribute to 2 legendary figures on this campus. One of them is Ian McTaggart Cowan, who headed the biology department and was instrumental in bringing Dr. Krebs to the campus. And the other one is our own Dennis Chitty, who was in the audience and was brought here to mentor his PhD program of Dr. Krebs. And these are men who've contributed many years to this university and probably should be given credit for their contributions to the university and to this institute. And if you'd like to join me in some applause for them. Now, with regard to tonight's subject, we all have seen endless tapes on television about polar bears. I know everything about the intimate life of a polar bear because it gets endless hours on television. What do I know about lemmings? Exactly what Dennis Chitty told us 15 years ago, and I haven't seen one mention of it in the press or on television since then. So today, we're going to get caught up. Now, ecology is a word that's on our lips constantly. There isn't a day goes by that something or other related to ecology isn't being argued, discussed, or fought about. Evidently, the Canadian ecology of the North is very important. Even though most of us live in the bottom 200 miles of Canada, we do lay claim to Canada going all the way to the North Pole. So the animals and birds that are up there should be important to us. If we claim that territory, we'd better be involved in the management. Now, how important are lemmings? Well, I've never seen a lemming coat. I've never seen a lemming steak. But evidently, they're very important in the food chain to some of the other ones who are up there, such as the lynx, the wolves, the foxes, the hawks, who need lemmings to survive on. And that and the snowshoe hare will be the subject of our lecture this evening. Now, to fill you in as to the lecturer, he was born and got his early education in St. Louis, Missouri. This happened back in 1936 that he was born. Got his first degree, a Bachelor of Science at the University of Minnesota, and then came here in 1958 for his master's and PhD studies. He became an assistant professor then at Indiana University and spent 5 or 6 years there as an assistant and then an associate professor. And then back to Vancouver, where he has been on faculty since 1970. The first 4 years as an associate professor, since then, full professor. He has published a great many books and articles, much too long for me to repeat. And he certainly has been recognized for his efforts. He's a member of the, or fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, the Norwegian Academy of Arts and Science. He's got the President's Medal from the University of Helsinki, Doctor of Science honoris causa from the University of Lund in Sweden, the Fry Medal from the Canadian Society of Zoologists, and here on our campus in 97, the Jacob Beely Prize in Research. And in 1998, show how far afield his reputation goes, honorary professor at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. So he's certainly recognized elsewhere, and it's long overdue that we recognize him here. What better recognition than to be the Saturday night speaker at the Vancouver Institute? May I present Charles Krebs.
Thank you, Dr. York. It's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you this evening. And I can figure out all of these buttons here. We'll turn a few lights down. It's probably too many. What's that? And okay, what I want to do this evening is to tell you two stories, basically, two natural history stories. The first about snowshoe hares and research which a large group of us from here at the University of British Columbia and other universities in Canada have done in the last 15 years there. Experimental studies. So in the process of telling you a lot of natural history this evening, I hope to give you some feeling for what field ecologists do, what experimental field ecologists do, how they spend their life chasing around in the Yukon, spending your wonderful taxpayers' money on basic research. And also I hope to tell you some stories about why we ought to do this and why we ought to do more of this. That'll occupy roughly the first half of the talk. And then we'll take you further north to the tundra and talk about Dennis Chitty's favorite animals, the lemmings, a little bit about their 3 to 4 year cycle and food chains in the Arctic that Dr. Yorsch has already alluded to. Okay, the first animal I want to talk about, our center of the talk on, is the snowshoe hare. The snowshoe hare, and this is a winter shot, they turn brown in the summer. The snowshoe hare is a nice, we all know what hares and rabbits look like. It's a nice size animal, about 3 pounds in weight on average. Now these are hares, that is to say, they do not burrow. They spend all of their life above ground. And their only safety, if you like, is in their feet and in their ears. They're very well named because they have very large hind feet, so they can move across very soft snow with very little problem. Now we would think, if we read the newspapers about temperatures in northern Canada, they would have problems with temperature. They do not. You'll hear me talk nothing about temperature for these animals. They're, in the winter, they're thermal neutral at about minus 30. That is to say, we're comfortable sitting in this room at about 20 degrees. A snowshoe hare was sitting in this room, it would be sweating, so to speak. It would be so hot. It would only be comfortable if this room was minus 30. So they never really worry about temperatures even as low as minus 50. In the winter, these are herbivores now, so they're eating the terminal twigs. of willows and birches, small shrubs, small trees. And so it doesn't sound like a very good diet, but these animals are supremely adapted to life in the boreal forest. Well, why should we study them? They have a 10-year cycle, and this has a very interesting history that I want to spend a few moments going over with you. The original data that, if you like, allowed us to discover that they had a 10-year cycle in their populations came from the Hudson's Bay Company archives. Beginning in 1670, the Hudson's Bay Company kept detailed records of the number of pelts traded in different regions of Canada. I'll show you some data in a little moment. And this was picked up by Charles Elton, the father of animal ecology, working at Oxford with Dennis Chitty many years ago when they set up the Snowshoe Rabbit Inquiry. People call these things rabbits even though they're truly hares. But this also had consequences for the balance of nature paradigm that I want to talk to you about, because I think it's one of the more misunderstood concepts in animal ecology. Okay, here's one of the time series from the Hudson's Bay Company from the west side of Hudson's Bay for about 100 years between 1820 and about 1920. These are the number of lynx pelts, Canada lynx, which I'll talk more about in a little bit, traded. Now the lynx, to give you a little natural history, is a specialist predator of snowshoe hares. That is to say, it eats almost nothing but snowshoe hares. Its diet is always 80, 90, 99% snowshoe hares. And their pelts are valuable, clearly, in the days when ladies wore fur coats, and some gentlemen too. And so their pelts were an avid thing for the fur trade, and you can see the numbers of pelts go up and down. And there are many time series like this spanning hundreds of years. There's a cycle in these numbers, and this is reflecting an underlying cycle in the snowshoe hare populations. Now, the fur of snowshoe hares in general is not terribly interesting for us, so the Hudson's Bay Company usually did not collect furs to ship to London from snowshoe hares, but they collected lots of lynx. So we have the lynx cycle, the 10-year cycle, the 9 to 10-year cycle, reflecting an underlying cycle in snowshoe hare numbers. Now, why was this interesting? In 1829, the prefect of the Hudson's Bay Company on the west side of Hudson's Bay wrote to the head office in London and said that the native people, the Indians as he called them, were starving in the region there. And he explained it is because rabbits had become scarce. This is the collapse phase of the cycle. The snowshoe hares become scarce. And he said because the rabbits had become scarce, all of the game in the surrounding countryside had become scarce, and the natives, the Indians which lived off this, were in a process of starvation. This happened routinely in the 1700s and the 1800s in Canada. Now, the balance of nature, and the reason these data from the Hudson Bay Company grab people, I think, is because up until that time, the early part of this century, people had an idea of the balance of nature, and the balance of nature was thought to be that nature is in a state of equilibrium or balance. That is to say, everything is level, nothing changes from year to year, and that's what we mean by the balance of nature. This is a very simple idea which was pervasive in the 18th and 19th century, and people today, you read the newspapers, still talk about it. It's completely wrong, and it was shown by that lynx data, by the snowshoe hare cycle from northern Canada. This balance was upset. You can see in a lynx cycle you have anything except balance or equilibrium. You have an enormous fluctuation, more than 100-fold from the bottom of the cycle to the top. And this is anything but balance. And this Charles Elton realized in the early part of this century just meant that the idea of there is a stable balance of nature is completely wrong. Northern Canada is relatively unimpacted by humans. And yet here we're having these enormous cycles and numbers. The prevailing paradigm, again, in the last century was that this balance was upset in two ways, because humans did something to mess up the world, and therefore things got out of balance. People had known way back in Aristotle's time that populations were not always stable, so they justified this. They said there is a balance of nature, but mankind fouls everything up now and then, and so we get outbreaks. And more religious people thought it was God punishing someone for doing something wrong and that's why we had grasshopper outbreaks or locust outbreaks or mouse outbreaks or whatever. But underneath all of this, in the pristine nature, you should have balance. But we don't have that now, and the ecologist's view of the balance of nature is a much more dynamic one than this old paradigm would have you believe. Now, the snowshoe hare lives in the boreal forests of Canada, and here's a map showing the green area, 5 million square kilometers, more than a third of Canada's boreal forests. These are the great spruce forests of the north, and some of you will have been the privilege to see these magnificent forests, and throughout that whole zone is this 9 to 10 year cycle I'm going to talk about here. Now, the boreal forest, of course, goes all the way around the globe. Northern Siberia has much boreal forest too, northern Fennoscandia, and approximately a quarter of the world's closed canopy forest is this boreal forest. Now, we don't talk in a conservation sense very much about this, but it's because our focus has always been on tropical problems, but as Canadians, in particular, because we have so much of the boreal forest, it is, I think, important for us to try to understand this ecosystem and to realize, in a global sense, it's a very large piece of real estate. Okay, if you go to the boreal forest, and I'm going to talk about the Yukon boreal forest tonight, largely where we've done most of our work, the first thing an ecologist wants to do is to find out who's out there in the community and who's eating whom. Okay, they construct these kinds of diagrams as shown here, which is basically what we call a food web. Okay, the food web in this case for this community has a series of plants along the bottom. The plant level across the middle is a series of herbivores. I have snowshoe hares in the middle there in yellow, the key player we wanted to talk about tonight. And then there's an array of predators up on the top. Basically tend to eat the herbivores, an array of bird predators on the left from great horned owls, goshawks, golden eagles, and so on, an array of mammal predators, lynx, coyotes, red foxes, wolves, and so on the right. And so all of those arrows hook together these predators and the main herbivores in the system, the snowshoe hare, the red squirrel, and the ground squirrel. Okay, so if you look at a diagram like this and you say, this is what an ecologist is supposed to be able to understand. And this is one of the main problems of ecology. This is true of all of the ecosystems which we have to study. And we have ecosystems that are of great value for conservation biology, and you could make a similar kind of diagram. Well, this is one for the boreal forest. And if you're an engineer or a physicist and you look at this diagram, you say, oh my goodness, it's impossible. How is anyone ever going to understand that system? And what do I mean by understanding this system? What I mean is what an ecologist needs to know, both for management and for conservation, is what would happen in this system if you plucked one of those players out of there. Let's suppose we could take the coyote, or the coyote's got some terrible disease and they all disappeared. What would happen to that tapestry of nature? What would happen if the snowshoe hare got some terrible virus disease and suddenly disappeared? How would that tapestry change? What species would go extinct, or would anything go extinct? How would it change the structure of how this ecosystem works? Now, that's the question we need to understand. It's the same question medical scientists are asking about the human body and so on, but now we're at the scale of an ecosystem. And ecologists need to know this for management. If you want to understand the salmon fishery here on the coast, if you want to understand the conservation of the Brazilian rainforest, you have this same question pounding at you. And you have this same overwhelming complexity. We are working now in northern Canada. This is a relatively simple system compared to something you would have, for example, in the Amazon. How can ecologists possibly understand that? Well, the only way we can do it is by tampering with the system experimentally. Let's poke it and see what happens. And that's what we've been doing for 15 years in the Yukon. Now, another way to do it is to try to isolate players in it. So this takes, if you like, this part of that food web. And now it's getting a bit more digestible. If you're an engineer, you see, well, maybe we could sort this one out. We're just really worried about the hares, a few of the main predators, owls, hawks, lynx, and coyote at the top, and a relatively small number of food plants at the bottom. It's still a fairly complicated piece of the web. And sometimes we can isolate pieces of the web and just talk about them. And it's one way to simplify this very complicated problem. Okay, we talked about the link cycle going on. It still goes on today, okay, to make a long story short. And here's some fur return data for different provinces of Canada for the last 80 or 90 years. And I want to make one point about this slide. One is that the hare cycle, the link cycle, goes on even today. But it also tends to occur in synchrony, that is, at the same time in different provinces. So all of Western Canada and Alaska, and in fact much of Canada, this year is at the peak of the hare cycle. So anywhere you go, as far as I've been able to find out, all the way across Canada, but certainly everywhere in the west, once you go to the northern forests, you'll find a great abundance of snowshoe hares. If you wait 3 or 4 years to go up there, you won't find scarcely a one. So not only are we having enormous gyrations in these populations, but we're having them in synchrony across these vast, relatively vast geographical areas, a problem I'll come back to later. Now, unfortunately, fur return data like this, if you're an economist, you realize it's all tied up with human behavior and the price of fur. You can see it kind of dithering away the last 10 years because it's not politically correct to wear furs anymore. They're not so valuable. You can see there was a problem during the war in the 1930s when, again, there was relatively little effort for economic reasons. So the fur returns don't accurately reflect exactly what happens in the system. Well, here's a geographical distribution of snowshoe hares. If you remember the geographical distribution of the boreal forest, it's exactly the same thing shown in white here. So what I'm talking about then is a cycle that's going on in hares throughout that whole white area. It's been studied in very few places because, if you like to think of it this way, one cycle takes 10 years, so it takes 10 years of my life. We have studied two and a half cycles now. We've been working in the Yukon for more than 25 years. That's a very slow rate, if you like to think of it, of doing experiments, one every 10 years. So we have worked up at Klawney Lake in the southwestern Yukon. I'll show you a few photos of that in a moment here. We've worked at the edge of Klawney National Park. Any of you who have been up the Alaska Highway, it's one of the largest parks in Canada, largely rocks and ice and incredibly beautiful glaciers like this, but on the east side of the park, a fringe of boreal forest where we have conducted most of these studies. This is the famous Alaska Highway before it was paved, leading down into the small hamlet of Haines Junction. And you can see here classical boreal forest, a very simple forest system. All of the dark colored trees there are white spruce trees, and you can see a tree line on the opposite slope there at about 1,000 meters, about 3,000 feet. The spruce die out, and above that you have tundra. Now the spruce and the snowshoe hare are exactly in the same place, so wherever there's spruce, there are snowshoe hares, and so they stop at tree line there. Now if you go up in an airplane and look at this valley near Haines Junction in the Yukon at the edge of Klawney National Park, you'll see it's a patchy landscape, and I've tried to label a little bit of that here. You can see the dark spruce forest on the left there in patches, but you also see some open patches, and these are fires. The history of fires is written on the landscape, and the boreal forest is spoken of as a kind of a fire-driven ecosystem. Fires are one of the main natural disturbances in these systems, and that's what produces patchiness when you get up and look at it. Now, none of this area so far has been logged, but the system is a very slow-working system. Okay, the stands on the left there, labeled as spruce forest, were established in either 1400 or 1500. That is to say, they're 500-year-old stands of spruce, and the trees, by our southern British Columbia standards, are relatively small trees. The burns here, which if you walked out into and looked at from your southern British Columbia perspective, you'd say, oh, this burn is probably 5 years old. Well, the burn is probably 100 years old. Everything is going very slowly. This is a very cold climate. And so the fire history, if you like, of this valley can be summed up in a relatively simple statement. If you sat down on a piece of real estate there and waited patiently to be burnt up, you'd get burnt up about once every 300 or 400 years. So it's going very slowly compared to our more southern forests. Well, what's there? Okay, An ecologist can make a list of species there, but in terms of understanding how the system works, you want to know who the main players are. This is a very simple attempt to summarize what's there. On the left are the herbivores, the things that eat plants, and you can see snowshoe hares in blue on the bottom. And this is just weight, okay, biomass or weight. So we say, if you're a predator wandering around out there, what can I eat? The main thing you can eat is snowshoe hares. You can eat red squirrels, they're in fair abundance, ground squirrels in yellow. Mice and voles in the green there, not very many of them. If you want to be a mouse specialist, there's not very much of them around, even less spruce grouse. If you wanted to eat solely spruce grouse, you would starve to death there. And the big things we like to think of, a grizzly bear and the moose, really are not major players out there. The main player in this system is the snowshoe hare. Ecologists would call it a keystone species. On the other side, well, who are the carnivores wandering around there chewing on things? The Canada lynx is one of the main players, the coyote and the wolf, again, about equal. The great horned owl is the main avian predator. And then there's a little purple there for the northern goshawks. So these are the main species I will talk about. So you have a system like this, and the ecologist says, well, what can we possibly do to see how this system operates? And here's a series of experimental manipulations our team, if you like, set out to do some nearly 15 years ago. So one thing you can do is reduce predation. Okay, so I'll show you some photos in a moment how we did these things, because again, I think one should understand all the effort that goes into this. You can reduce predation. If you think predation is an important feature of the community, let's try to reduce it and see what happens. You can increase food supply. If we add more food, will that cause numbers to go up greatly? You can do both of these. You can try to change both predation and food. These are the factors you think that are structuring the way that community operates. On the other hand, if you're a gardener mentality, you can say, let's put some fertilizer out. Let's make the plants grow better. You have to realize the forest in the boreal zone is incredibly low in nutrients. If you took your garden soil test kit to the Yukon and test soil, it will tell you there's nothing in the soil. Everything is zero. There are very low nutrients in these soils, so you can put out fertilizer and improve things. Or you can keep snowshoe hares. Now, snowshoe hares are the main things that are munching down all the greenery. What happens if you keep them out of an area? And so these are the experiments which we did, and I want to very briefly talk about what has come of them. Here's how we kept predators out. It's an electric fence. You get some feeling for it, about 7 feet tall. The wires have 8,600 volts going through them, and mammalian predators like lynx and coyotes learn very quickly to stay out of this area, and as do people. And you can see we built a very large area. Tony Sinclair certainly did a lot of this work. My colleagues here, this is 1 square kilometer blocks now of forest surrounded by this 8,000 volt electric fence. Many tales of woe in building this. We wanted to keep bird predators out, and this is a colossal problem because we hung up fishing net. This is a kind of an aerial view of fishing net. You can get fishing net off the Fraser River down here by the square mile as fishermen throw away. And so we strung it up in the trees like this to keep the birds of prey off the ground, a terrible disaster. Of course, all the native people there thought we were totally insane hanging fishing net in trees. But that didn't work. The snow brought it down. As one of my colleagues, Jamie Smith, we put up monofilament fishing line. And that worked a bit better, but it was very difficult to keep the birds out of these areas. We spread food around, commercial rabbit chow with a tractor like this by the tons, up to 30 to 40 tons a month when we were feeding a lot of hares. We spread fertilizer with some mad pilots from Alberta who flew these crop dusting kinds of planes, 110 tons of fertilizer had to be put out every spring on 2 blocks of boreal forest. And so you begin to get the feeling there's almost an engineering problem to doing all these kinds of manipulations on a large scale in the boreal forest. We had a lot of fun doing this, of course. Here we're building a hare and moose exclosure. That is to say, we wanted to have an area roughly the size of this building that we would keep hares out of. And so here's a 12-foot tall fence that we put up. Moose are incredibly stupid animals. They will walk through anything, and so we thought if we made this a bright orange fence, they would kind of walk up to it and walk away, but still, every now and then a moose would walk through this fence and we'd have to repair it. There's one of my colleagues, Rudy Boonstra. There were eight of us working on this project, and Rudy is on the faculty at University of Toronto. Irene Wingate, one of our technicians here with the baby bunny here. Now, the one thing we did demand of all of the students and workers on the project is absolute fealty to the faculty, so we'd have these early morning rituals. This is Tony Sinclair being adored by his graduate students. Okay, so what are we trying to get at? Now, let me give you two caricatures of how these communities can operate. And this is the so-called bottom-up model. This says the world out there is run by nutrients. This is the kind of gardener approach. So what you really, if you want to change the world, this view says, put out more nutrients, because the nutrients feed up into the plants. You get more plants. When you get more plants, you get more herbivores. There's more grub to eat. When you get more herbivores, you get more carnivores because they have more herbivores to eat. Now you can see if you're in charge of conserving a national park, whatever, some kind of an ecosystem, if this is the kind of operations that are going on there, it's important to know that, because if you want to change something, you change it from the bottom up. But this may not be the way the world works, and it turns out this is not the way the forest works. It works by the opposite model, the so-called top-down model. The top-down model says that predators run the world, okay? The carnivores control the herbivores. The herbivores, in turn, control the plants. The plants, in turn, control the nutrients. Now, in this system, if you add nutrients, nothing's going to happen. The system is run from the top. It's not run from the bottom. And so in a management sense, if you want to change the world, don't fiddle around with nutrients. Fiddle around, so to speak, with the predator end of things, the top end of things. So these are clearly two caricatures, two extreme views. The truth is somewhere near the middle, but this one, in fact, is closer to to reality for the boreal forest. Well, let me very briefly describe some of the results here. And this is a cartoon of what happens with those experiments I very briefly described. Just in terms of the snowshoe hare numbers. So if we have one hare, so to speak, on over this 10 years of cycles on the snowshoe, on the control grids, that is the unmanipulated grids, we fertilize the area. Nothing happens. We still have one hair on it. As I've just indicated, this is not a bottom-up system. If we reduce the predators, we double the number of hairs. That's pretty good. If we add food, we get triple. We get three times the number of hairs. They really like rabbit chow. They come in better. But what happens when you combine these, when you both keep out the predators with this electric fence, and you add food, you end up with 10 times more hairs. So you get the largest, if you like, response with some combined treatment, both keeping predators off the hare's back and allowing them access to very high quality food. Okay, so there's a key somewhere in how predators and food are interacting in this system. Now I want you to contrast this. This is one of the main players, of course, the snowshoe hare that we're mainly talking about. The next slide will show you what happens with red squirrels, which are the tree squirrel, which we're all familiar with the same experiments. Okay, so here's the red squirrel, the same treatments, and you don't have to look very long at this to see that nothing happens. The red squirrels are completely unaffected by all of these treatments. Now, the red squirrels in particular don't like the food we put out. They don't like to eat rabbit chow. They'd rather eat seeds, so the food addition doesn't do anything. We weren't surprised about this. But predators are not a problem with red squirrels. The red squirrel, and all of you have seen squirrels, they laugh at predators. They're not quite immune to predators, but they by and large laugh at predators as they sit up in their tree and the lynx is on the ground kind of trying to get at them, but can't get to them. So we have different parts of the system now responding differently to these different kinds of treatments. Okay, well, why should snowshoe hares ever die? Let me again try to summarize a lot of work which we've done. They die 90% of the time. The cause of death, the coroner's report, is a predator killed them. Now you can tell that because we can hang little radios around their necks and find them almost immediately when they die. So 90% of the time, why did this hare die? A predator ate it. Okay, predators are the main thing driving this system. Parasites and diseases, things ecologists worry about, don't seem to be very relevant in this system. Starvation, we almost could never find a snowshoe hare that died of starvation. The thing driving the system here immediately is predation. Okay, I want to mention a few things about reproductive changes. Female snowshoe hares, which typically live only 1 or 2 years, will have generally 4 litters during the summer, at the best of times. That is to say roughly 20 offspring in the summer. But what happens as the cycle builds up, females start to turn off their reproductive rate. They only have 3 litters, or then they cut it back to 2 litters. And in the decline phase, when the hares are doing most poorly, the females are not, so to speak, putting their energy into reproduction. And this is one of the great puzzles of the hare cycles. What's telling the females, kind of stop bothering to breed, don't have so many babies. And this is one of the things which we're still puzzling over. But one of the most interesting findings about this was something Tony Sinclair from this university found. He was bringing hares to UBC down to South Campus to study them right through the whole cycle. When you bring them into captivity, of course, they don't have to worry about diseases anymore. You feed them well. They don't have any predators to worry about. They're all isolated from each other, so they're not fighting with each other. So he kept them in ideal conditions. And when you do this, of course, they live quite a long time, rather longer than they do in the field, where they don't have predators eating them. And what he found is that the hares down here on South Campus, reproductive performance was mimicking exactly what was going on 3,000 kilometers to the north in the Yukon. That is to say, the females down here were just not breeding very well and the hares up north were declining. Okay, so we don't know what this means yet. Basically, there's some program in here. Something is telling this female, so to speak, and you can think of this as a physiological program or a genetic program. We don't know what it is. Something is telling this female, don't bother to produce a lot of babies, even under ideal conditions on the South Campus. So this is one of the puzzles, as they say. We haven't yet sorted out. And here's a baby bunny, and one of the surprising things we discovered, these are born fully furred with their eyes open because they're hares. And they are the worst mothers in the world, I should point out, because the female attends to the young, feeds them once a day for about 15 minutes. So about midnight, mother comes back to the young sitting in the grass like this, feeds them 10 or 15 minutes, and then goes off, comes back 23 hours and 45 minutes later, feeds them, goes off. So all the day they're just sitting there, basically waiting to be eaten. And we thought, what happens to these little guys? You know, they could hold them in your hand. They're only 3 or 4 ounces when they're born. And so we put little radio tags on them and discovered who's eating these guys are red squirrels, largely red squirrels and ground squirrels. Now, red squirrels are supposed to be herbivores. That is to say, they're supposed to eat seeds and mushrooms. And here they are eating these poor, innocent baby bunnies. Now, we spent 3 years trying to convince our squirrel crew that these red squirrels are real killers, and red squirrels are real killers. We finally got videotape of them with blood dripping out of their jaws killing these baby bunnies. So here's a herbivore, so to speak, killing another herbivore. Now clearly when they get to be a few weeks old, they can run fast and they get away from the squirrels, but in the first 2 weeks of life they're very vulnerable to squirrel predation. Okay, so here are the two main terrestrial predators in the system. Canada lynx on the right, its great feet for walking on snow, and the coyote, a new, relatively new invader to the north. And the great horned owl, this one with a radio tag on its tail mount. A large owl is another main predator of the snowshoe hare that we studied quite a lot. And the northern goshawk, a relatively rare species, and this is an interesting one because it's on one of the potential threatened species lists in British Columbia. Its numbers have been going down. It is also a snowshoe hare, a specialist predator. Now, predators, what happens? The hare numbers go down, okay? What a choice, what can a predator do when this happens? Now, you got three choices. You can stay and change your diet, okay? You can't eat hares, so you can't find very many hares. So, and what else can you eat? If you remember the diagram back there, you can eat red squirrels, really. Arctic ground squirrels sleep all winter. They're hibernate. So if you're out there in the winter, there's nothing else to eat except red squirrels. Or you can eat other predators, and they do all of these things. Predators kill each other when hares become scarce. It's really a dog-eat-dog world out there. Many of them starve to death. The second option, you can sit around trying to catch hares. If you don't catch enough, you starve. Or you go walkabout, and many of them go walkabout. We know this again because of radio collaring. We and other people have studied lynx, Canada lynx, that have moved 1,000 kilometers. So we've tagged them here, picked them up 1,000 kilometers away in every direction. And this seems to be nothing to eat here, go next door, and then they just keep wandering and they turn up in somebody's trap line in Alaska over in the Mackenzie. And so predators really take it on the nose when the hares go down. It is their main source of food. So what we end up then is with, again, back to this food web, and just to try to answer my question very briefly, what happens if we pluck something out of there? If we pluck the snowshoe hare out of that system, there would be a dramatic change in the system. It would really collapse. The predators, on the other hand, we could probably take a few of those out without any problems. They compensate for each other. Okay, I want to go off and talk briefly about the lemmings, which are one of my favorite animals. Again, we have historical data from Dennis Chitty and Charles Elton set up many years ago to find out about these short-term cycles. As all you know, lemmings commit suicide by jumping off cliffs. Now Dennis Chitty has told us they don't do that. But there are many myths about lemmings. The Inuit of northern Canada, one of the names for one of the lemmings is falling from the sky. And so we should talk a little about what gives rise to these myths about lemmings. Here's a collared lemming. There are basically two lemmings in the Canadian Arctic, collared lemming. Now this is an animal that will sit in your hand. Very short tail, very short ears, weighing 2 or 3 ounces, a very small rodent. And here's one coming out of its burrow with a little ear tag in it. They all have numbers, like our undergraduate students. And an ecologist basically wants to solve this equation. We want to know how population density changes. It's got input from births and deaths. It's got input from births and immigration. It's got output from deaths and emigration. And so this has occupied a lot of our time. Now, Dennis Chitty recognized many years ago that most people looked at lemming populations and other populations in this way. And I have been talking that way largely about snowshoe hares. There's a whole set of things that impinge on these populations, like predators, like parasites and diseases. But he and others recognized some years ago now that lemming population really isn't just a single unity. Each individual in that population has a certain sex and therefore a certain set of behaviors and physiology, certain genetic constitution, and there could be things going on within that green circle as well as things going on outside in those other parameters. Okay, so I want to take you up to the high Arctic now, the tundra, which is another third of Canada, which many of us don't have the ability to visit, and then two sites I'll talk about briefly there on the Arctic coast. And just to kind of keep the tourists happy, we put up this sign. Unfortunately, we never got Dennis Chitty up there to see this sign. But okay, the one thing that I think has generated most of the myths about lemmings is winter breeding. Until roughly the turn of the last century, and no one knew that lemmings could breed under the snow in the winter. And this, again, it seems to me to be a physiological miracle, and it's kind of counter to our sense. And what would happen is, you know, there'd be no lemmings around if you were an Inuit living in the area, or a Norwegian peasant, and then the snow would come, and then the snow would melt the next spring, and there are lemmings all over the place running around. Well, where did they come from, okay? You can see where the mythology, if you think they cannot breed under the snow in the winter, they must have either fallen from the sky in rainstorms, and there are good, solid quotations of people writing in the last century how they saw lemmings falling from the sky in rainstorm, why they migrated in, you know, they marched across from the mountains somewhere and came there, but people only gradually realized they can breed under the snow in the winter, and these animals do not hibernate. They're munching away under the snow. They're, again, very happy in cold temperatures. And this ability to breed in the winter is a source of much of the mythology of where did they come from. Now, the colored lemming, again, it's a bit like the snowshoe hare, is being chewed on in these study sites by a great array of predators, from the Arctic fox and the red fox, weasels and grizzly bears, ground squirrels, snowy owls. All of these various predators are chewing away on, and these northern, and this is partly, of course, why we studied them, these are focal species. What do you want to eat if you're up there, so to speak, if you're a predator? Again, the only thing you can really eat in very large amounts, if you're a relatively small predator, are lemmings. And they are the central and focus of the food chain. Here's a weasel, one of the main, or the ermine as it's called, in its winter coat when it turns white. And these guys are just designed to go into lemming burrows and chew on them. So they're one of the main predators. Arctic fox, the next one, a very small fox, not as big as the foxes we have down here. It also turns white in the winter. And this is another one of the main predators of lemmings. They love to munch on them. One of the surprising things we found out is the Arctic ground squirrel. This is the same animal I talked about in the boreal forest. It's a typical ground squirrel, a little over a pound. And they hibernate in the winter. In the summer, again, they're supposed to be a herbivore. They eat a lot of plants, and we found they also eat lemmings. They dig up lemming burrows, kill lemmings, and eat them, okay? So here's a herbivore acting as a predator in the system. So the poor lemming is getting eaten by everybody up there. Now, what we did to try to get some information on the predation there is to build a fence up in the Arctic. So it's a bit like the fence you saw. This covering 10 hectares, about 25 acres. So I don't know what that is, but you know, a good piece of the campus here. And so there's a fence around the outside. The inside of it is covered with monofilament fishing line, about 4 feet off the ground. We put up 300 kilometers of fishing line by hand, line after line, which keeps the avian predators from being able to get the lemmings on the tundra. Now, we weren't thinking very much. Here's my wife, Alice Kenny, looking for radio collared lemmings, and the monofilament's 4 feet tall, so you kind of get a permanent stoop and trying to get under this. And so the next one we built higher up, but you know, we for a while there we were certain, you know, kind of seriously kidding, we should only take graduate students that were less than 4 feet tall. So what happens when you put this up again, to make a long story short? You keep the predators out. You have a fence around the outside and this fishing line over the middle. You really do keep the predators out. You improve the survival of the adults that are in there dramatically. The predators are really hammering them in these areas. But what happens is the juveniles born inside there, again, for reasons we do not know at the moment, move outside. They don't seem to recognize this as a haven of safety. They march and they can go right through the fence. They march outside the fence and into the jaws of the birds of prey and everything living outside. And so the fence never does produce, if you like, a great population explosion, as we hoped that it did. So it helps to increase density a bit, but it really doesn't drive the lemming cycle. Well, I'm getting on in my time here. I might just press on with this. I should just mention again, the lemming cycle, similar to the hare cycle, is a great change in reproduction through the cycle. And let me just talk about winter breeding, the main point here. You get winter breeding only in some years, and this is a mystery. Why does it only occur 1 year or 2 years out of every 3 or 4? Some winters they breed under the snow, other winters they do not. And we don't know why this is. It doesn't seem to be a simple nutritional thing. We think there's more to it. So there are two reasons, I think, yeah, why do lemmings go up and down. There are two kinds of changes. One set is associated with crowding. Territorial strife, these lemmings are incredibly territorial. They're infanticidal. That is to say, and for once I can be proud of being a male, it's the female lemmings that are killing each other's babies. These are really nasty animals. The males, I should say a little bit about their social system. A female lemming will live in an area roughly half the size of this room. That'll be your home range. A male lemming is kind of the philanderer. He wanders over kind of like half the campus here looking for females. Okay. So a male lemming never has any idea whose kids he's the father of, to kind of justify things a bit. So he never goes around killing babies. But a female who lives in the front of the room knows that the kids in the back of the room belong to another female. She goes over there when she gets a chance and kills the poor thing when they're in the nest and they're little. So there's infanticide in these things. They're very nasty. And of course, by killing the kids up there, her kids have more room to expand and so on. So there's a nasty game going on associated with infanticide. There's also predation, all those things. Eating lemmings have some impact on them. Perhaps not as large as the impact in snowshoe hares, but when lemmings are common, they get chewed on. Another spin-off of the lemming cycle has been onto geese nesting. The predators that live largely, like foxes that live largely off lemmings, go after geese. So geese have reduced nesting success when lemmings are abundant. And we've had a student just finish a thesis on this, but the basic story is the foxes and so on, they can't really get to the adult geese, or very rarely do they get an adult goose, but they can get the eggs and the little goslings when they hatch. And so you get a change, if you like, in goose production that follows the lemming cycle as a kind of a secondary consequence. Now this is, of course, interesting to people. People don't eat lemmings, but they do eat geese, and there are a lot of goose hunters. If you're reading the paper today, we have a great surplus of geese, so it's no real problem. But people are worried about this spin-off of the lemming cycle on the geese. Here's a Canada goose on a nest. Okay, let me just mention some of our other work in the north. It's been an attempt to get at this question of synchrony. And with the lemming cycle, as with the snowshoe hare cycle, regional areas will all be doing the same thing at the same time. All the populations will be high. If you want to see lemmings in the central Arctic, go this summer. If you go a year or two from now, you won't find any. You'll find lots this year. So what we tried to do is ask the question, how can we get at the question of synchrony? One way is to look at island populations. Find populations isolated on islands. And this is the central Arctic near Cambridge Bay, the Kent Peninsula. And so all those dots there, some are mainland sites, but there's several islands which are out far enough, 10 or 20 kilometers offshore, that the lemmings on there are there. There's no exchange very much in the one on Victoria Island across the way. And to ask the question, are these guys in synchrony? Are they all doing the same thing at the same time? And if so, how do they know that this is the year to do everything and next year will be low again? How do they agree upon this? This shows you just some surveys we've done. I'll just flip through these and you can see the general message is, save for the one island, they're all high in 96. They're all coming up to a peak again. This year and the next year, they're all low. And the next year, they're all low. So this whole central Arctic is going through population cycles. Now at the moment, this is kind of a very schematic kind of overview of regions of synchrony in the Canadian Arctic, and data are never very good. We don't have a lot of stations testing this. But there's an area at the top there in sort of peach color. It includes the area I've talked about, northern Baffin Island, that probably goes down even to Ungava. And those areas all seem to be in phase. The area in the Barren Ground, centered on Baker Lake, to the south, seems to be at least a year out of phase. Over to the west, a year out of phase, west of the Mackenzie. The North Yukon, for reasons we've been completely unable to explain, never has any cycles. They're absolutely flat there, a real balance of nature. And northern Alaska has cycles which, again, seem to be about a year off. So what you have is, what this means is there's a whole suite of predators, Arctic foxes, snowy owls, that are kind of playing a very large chess game, going around, sort of saying, where in the Arctic are lemmings high this year? Let's all go over there. And this is probably includes Siberia, so there's probably a massive movement of foxes and snowy owls over this large piece of real estate, because these lemmings are not all everywhere doing the same thing in the same year. The predators can play this kind of patch, hide and seek, if you like. And this obviously has impacts for conservation. Okay, so let's try to sum up here. We've got two cycles. We've got snowshoe hares, a 9 to 10 year cycle. We've got lemmings, a 3 to 4 year cycle, and another series of mice and voles. And we think the predators are involved in both of them. Perhaps predators are somewhat less important for the lemmings. Their so-called intrinsic regulation, or if you like, the impacts of crowding, changing reproductive rates in lemmings, changing infanticide, and so on. And we think these things are going on. We certainly don't understand all of them. But these seem to be the key processes, if you like, that are driving the dynamics of these northern ecosystems. Okay, so now let me try to close by giving you a few reasons why we should care about this. I think what I've talked to you largely about is basic research. But it's basic research that has, I think, some importance, not immediately economically important. The snowshoe hare, certainly in the snowshoe hare cycle, controls and largely the fur trade in Canada. The history of the fur trade is largely tied up with these snowshoe hare cycles. Now, there's a great problem in northern Canada. What are the native people to do? Economically, and fur is certainly one important thing in the boreal forest, that if they can sell the furs, the fur trade is an important economic thing. This is underlined by the hare cycle. So if you're interested in practical matters, I think that is a practical spin-off of trying to understand the snowshoe hare cycle. It has impacts on the fur trade. But largely the work I've described to you today that my colleagues and I have done is really under the aegis of basic research. And it is really an attempt to try to understand how these systems work. How does the ecosystem work in the real world? Why does not the Canada lynx go extinct? Why does the snowy owl not go extinct when lemmings' numbers go down or hare numbers go down? These are questions ecologists must be able to understand if we're going to manage our populations right here in the southern areas and in tropical areas. There are very few ecosystems on Earth yet, like the boreal forest and like the tundra, that are relatively undisturbed by human impacts. And just as it's very important for medical scientists to study healthy people so they can understand sick people, it's very important for ecologists to study healthy ecosystems to try to help them get some background to understanding what happens when things start to go wrong, either because of pollution effects, climate change effects, a whole array of things which mankind is doing to our ecosystems. And one of the key focal things I think we are worried about in the north is climate models. That we're all worried about climate change models. Now all predict the maximum effect of temperature change on northern ecosystems. British Columbia down here, the last models I see, the things are not going to change very much. But in northern systems, they're going to change dramatically. And so I think it's incumbent on us, if we're worried about the conservation of these magnificent systems, to be able to tell our children and grandchildren something about how these systems work, how these baby birds, these golden eagles in this case, survive, how these baby ground squirrels are nasty because they go out and kill snowshoe hares or whatever, but they also have their place in the ecosystem. Thank you.
I'm sure Dr. Krebs has only given us a portion of what he knows about these, and therefore will receive questions. Please word your questions as briefly as you can, because we'd like to hear from him rather than long preambles. So who will we start with? Dr. Clark.
That's a very good question of what we forecast to occur in lemming populations in the next 10 or 20 years. I think for the next 10 or 20 years, we do not see any problems, if you like, in lemming conservation. climate change effects, I think, that are going to be most serious are probably 50 years down the road. And there are a whole group of people trying to work out what the consequences of these are, largely for the vegetation. So I think the climate change impact will feed through the vegetation first and on to the lemmings. So I don't think in terms of immediate conservation problem, I think the lemming cycle will carry on happily for the next 10 or 20 years, and probably the next 50 and hopefully 100 years. But clearly at some point, when the climate starts to get dramatically warmer, well, just to take a very simple thing, these guys cannot cope with very warm temperatures. If you try to keep them, so to speak, in your house, the males all become infertile because it's too warm for them to generate sperm, for example. So now we're not facing that at the moment, but that could be a long-term effect of climate change. So I think the short answer is I don't see any great problems in the next little while. Now, you know, the human presence in the tundra, as you all know, is really minimal. So if I had to say, is there any conservation problem whatsoever in the north, I think it is probably in the areas around human settlements where one of the worst problems, the lemmings live at the ground-snow interface, and when you run a snowmobile over the snow in the winter, you collapse this ground-snow interface, where the lemmings are doing their little tunneling, and turn it basically to either a sheet of ice or hard-packed snow, which they have much more trouble getting through. And so I think if you go to an Inuit settlement now, where everybody's running around their snowmobiles around town, you'll probably find no lemmings within anywhere near town where they do all this running around. So that's a minor problem because there's still large areas of landscape which aren't being bothered, but just that kind of thing can be an impact on populations that we tend not to think about.
Thank you.
Yes?
You mentioned that predators move when there's a low availability of food, and I think you mentioned the lynx.
Yes.
Do other predators like the bears, do they move as well, or has there been any studies on this?
There's less data, I think, than we would like to have on the other predators. Grizzly bears in particular, I do not think, probably move very much. They're pretty strongly territorial. Typically, in all of these large predators, the juveniles kind of go walk about until they find a nice place to settle down, then they stay there. So what's unusual about the lynx when its food supply drops out, and this probably is true in the coyote, but we do not have these kind of radio collared things. The lynx food supply falls away and they give up their territory. It's like you giving up your house and saying, yeah, I'm going to walk to Saskatchewan or wherever and hope that I can find something better. So that's pretty unusual for these large carnivores. They usually carve out a big territory and hang in there. And the grizzly bear in particular eats a whole variety of things. It's often typically a vegetarian more than a predator. So I think they hang in there more than the lynx. But I think these systems are really dramatic in that, boy, the food supply goes, you know, from having 100 hares all around you to having maybe one and start to get hungry. And they kill each other. These predators, again, I probably may have mentioned it, terrible. The lynx will kill each other. Wolves will kill lynx. Coyotes will kill lynx. Lynx will kill coyotes. They all will eat. It's dog eat dog. I mean, that's a good description of this world out there. It's not a nice place. Yes? Well, there's a problem with trying to, it's a good, very good question, whether ozone hole and climate change has had any impact on northern Canada yet. I think the problem with trying to answer that is this problem of having no evidence and saying no evidence means nothing is happening, okay? If you don't study anything, and there's nobody up there in northern Canada, one of the great crises of the moment, is the amount of research money this government puts into research in northern Canada. It is falling precipitously, like our medical expenses. Every year, there are fewer and fewer people. Just to give you a figure now, there is more money spent on research in northern Canada by the Americans than by the Canadians, and by the Swedes than the Canadians. So Sweden somehow thinks it's more valuable to study things in northern Canada than our government does. So if you don't study these things, you don't find out about them. But and I can only give you a personal anecdote. We discovered, after we've been working there many years, my wife and I, that some almost 10 years ago now, we started getting incredible, almost boils on our skin from working there in the summer. I've been working in the north a long time, never had this problem. You get a nice sunburn. And we turned out, we came back south and read the paper, and they said this is the worst year yet for the ozone hole. The ozone hole is very bad up there, and UV was very strong. And as soon as we came south and got out of there, these things healed up. So now it's not going to affect, you know, people who Inuit if they stay inside and watch TV all day. So, but and who knows what it's doing to the animals? So there's nobody up there studying that. I would have to say at the moment, nobody, you know, the answer to your question would be we don't know of any great impacts yet. But I'd also have to say there's not an awful lot of work to make one very comfortable that. The largest worry, I think, has been that what the climatic warming will do is change the Arctic from a CO2 sink, as it's called, that is to say CO2, which we produce down here with our burning coal and everything and automobiles, goes up to the Arctic and falls, so to speak, into the tundra. It's put into peat and so on. So it's a sink for CO2. Once you start to heat up the Arctic, you change it into a source, that is to say, the peat starts to decompose and it generates CO2. So now the Arctic starts to pump out CO2. So we're pumping out CO2 down here. The Arctic starts to pump out CO2. That's going to raise the rate at which CO2 goes up. That's one of the main greenhouse gases. The world's going to warm up even faster. So that's what scientists call a positive feedback loop. The warmer we make it, the faster the CO2 comes out. And so if you worry about climate change and CO2 in particular, that's been the main worry in the Arctic. And, it's kind of teetering at the brink now exactly where we are. Whether there's a great problem. Scientists are arguing about where the CO2 is. Where the sink is. Is it in the forest? Is it in the tundra? So I'd have to say at the moment, a long-winded answer, that we don't really know of any great things to worry about, but I think there's a lot of more research that needs to be done. Scientists always say that, don't they? We need more research, but you know, we do, for goodness sakes. Yes, question? Walt Disney, as far as we can make out. Walt Disney... Oh, you don't really want to know this, but I guess Walt's gone to heaven now, so we don't have to worry about besmirching his name, but he was buying all these lemmings from Eskimo Inuit children, and they shipped them, various stories, they shipped them down to Southern California and shoveled them off the cliff. If you saw that movie where they were jumping off the cliff, and you look very carefully, they were coming over the cliff backwards and upside down. They were running on a gravel lot. It was just, it's terrible to be an Arctic biologist and look at that Disney thing. It's so, that's not the worst of the stories I could tell you about what Walt Disney did to make some of those Arctic movies. But there's always been a myth in Norway, again tied up with this fact that lemmings fall from the sky. The lemmings migrate down from the mountains. You know, where did they come from? They must have migrated, the more rational people would say, they don't fall from the sky. For goodness sakes, they must have migrated down the hill, walked 100 kilometers, and here they are now. So this winter breeding, I think, is the source of a lot of it. And Walt Disney kind of capitalized on it in the 50s. And then, of course, the newspapers just love this. They're always talking about lemmings jumping, or, you know, stockbrokers being like lemmings or whatever. They like the analogy. So it's one of these things that's kind of, you know, you feel bad telling people, look, they don't jump off cliffs. Look, the whole Canadian Arctic, if you've ever been there, you have to look for hundreds of miles to even find a cliff, you know. So. Yes, Peter?
You mentioned the synchronized reproductive cycle of the hares between Kewanee and UBC.
Yep.
In the puzzle. What theories are you examining about this?
My favorite theory is that there's some kind of, if you like, it's kind of the thing Dennis Chitty likes, that there are two kinds of snowshoe hares out there. If you like, there's a kind of a reproductive type that has a high reproductive output. And there's a less reproductive type that has, if you like, is selected for ability to run away from predators or avoid predators better. And then what you're seeing over the cycle is an oscillation of these two types. That's a genetic explanation. The alternative, I think, that the best alternative at the moment is that it's a kind of a stress effect on individuals. There's a lot of interest, of course, in the effects of stress on people and its impact on brain reorganization. And so this is a kind of phenotypic thing which says, look, these poor hares, you got to feel sorry for them. They're out there. They don't, as I say, they don't burrow. They're sitting on top of the snow every day, all night, all year, you know. And everything's out there trying to eat them. The poor things are chased several times. We've tracked a lot of predators in the winter. It's one out of every four or five chases is successful. So they're chased several times. They spend their life getting chased, you know, and so, and then they get eaten. So, you know, what a way to live, eh? Or die. Anyway, so we think that's a hell of a stress on them, eh? And, you know, maybe this has the impact that stress has on human beings. And that this, obviously, if it gets too serious, even in humans, it's transmitted to your children and even your grandchildren, I gather, their data. So that's a phenotypic stress kind of explanation for it. And so I would say there are these two kind of competing ideas, some kind of selection and some kind of stress, maternal effects, whatever you want to call them. Yes?
You have indicated that the food web was considerably more complicated in tropical forests. I wonder whether these studies have given any similar indication for tropical keystone species
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the whole idea of whether there are keystone species in tropical systems is, I think, an active area of argument. I think the evidence at the moment is, at least for terrestrial systems in the tropical kind of rainforest habitats, you do not have this kind of dominance by one thing like the snowshoe hare, one species. But you have to temper that kind of wisdom, if you like, by the fact there have been relatively few comprehensive studies like this in the tropics. And what ecologists have tended to do, faced with that incredibly complicated web, which, as you say, is even more complicated in the tropics, is to take one small piece of it and say, oh, I'm going to study this butterfly, you know, which pollinates this plant. And so there are, in the tropical studies, a lot of elegant studies of one butterfly on one or, you know, several plants, and maybe a bird or something that eats the butterflies or its larvae or something. And so the whole system is somehow left out as though it's irrelevant. Now that may be the way, the truth, if you like, but it also may be neglecting a whole lot of interactions that you kind of shut out just by looking at your one butterfly. And so I think the problem is to do these large-scale kinds of studies in tropical areas, and I think people are starting to do it. There's a lot of work in the Amazon, but the complexity is overwhelming. And these studies, I mean, there's a whole kind of sociology of science, which I think is fascinating here, because how do you get all these people pointed in the same direction, looking at one system for a long time period? We spent 10 to 15 years on this project. That's a group of colleagues here who mercifully still speak to me, but, you know, try to keep 10 faculty members marching in the same direction for 10 years. It's like, you know, you need a degree in psychiatry or something, and not to mention all the graduate students. And so I think, and there's a problem, the university rewards people, not on the basis of having done a whole big group study of Amazon rainforest or whatever. You know, it always has this idea there's one guy who does everything. In ecology, that doesn't happen. There are many, many people contributing to projects, and we don't really have in our social system, I think, a way of rewarding people to do that kind of work. So I think that's been part of the problem. And then, of course, an eternal shortage of money for these funding. I think E.O. Wilson, in one of his latest books, pointed out there was more money spent in the bars of New York City in one night than conservation research spent for 10 years. And maybe it was 100 years, I don't know, some astronomical thing, but, you know, people value drinking in bars more than studying Amazon rainforest. So I think the problem with the tropics, again, a long-winded response, is we don't have as many of these studies as we should have. Superficially, it does not look like they're so dominated by keystone species. Yes?
Did they do that because of some potential commercial value?
Now that's a good question. I don't know the exact answer to that. My understanding is that snowshoe hare... Oh, sorry. The Hudson Bay Company kept some records of snowshoe hare pelts. And why did they do this? Was it for some commercial use? They certainly, as far as I know, never shipped them to London like they did all the other ones. They used snowshoe hare pelts locally, so the native people would use them locally, and so I think some posts kept some records for relatively short time periods of the number of pelts that came in and were just sold locally. And so you didn't have this Canada-wide kind of network of data like you had for the lynx. And I think, you know, basically the hare pelts, I don't know, the native people obviously use them a little bit, but not very much. And so I think in terms of value, it wasn't worth shipping them off to London. The ladies of the continent didn't want to have snowshoe hare fur coats. I don't think a snowshoe hare fur coat would be very nice. A lynx coat is a magnificent thing.
Dr. Gardner?
Yes? Where do we get our funding? Through the NSERC, Natural Science and Engineering Research Council. And they've been very good to us. And I meant to thank all of you people, patient taxpayers of Canada, for supporting basic research. You know, I obviously am a beneficiary of it, but I think it is one of the semi-altruistic things we taxpayers do that we ought to be congratulated for. And we're always saying we need more money. Everybody needs more money. Yes? Yeah, I should have said so, Siberia. Russian data is peculiarly Russian, another whole story, but basically they have the same thing going on there, these 10-year cycles in the hares. Lots of lemming data, same thing going on, same cycles, so they're circumpolar. The only slightly weird place is Fennoscandia, another whole story, but I have to have another lecture to get at that one. But basically that whole boreal forest is doing the same thing. Yes? Yeah, that's a good question, whether these cycles are really only a northern phenomenon, as it says in many of the textbooks. And again, we go back to this problem of, with regard to tropical data. I think that's probably true, that these cycles are more rare, and the typical hand-waving explanation is that in relatively simple systems dominated by a few keystone species like this, you can get these cycles. But as you go south, things get more complicated and they disappear. But you have to temper that with the realization again that look how long a time series do you need to see a cycle. And then you go to the tropical rainforest and say, now who's measured a butterfly population, say in Costa Rica, for 30 or 40 or 50 years? All right, to take northern Canada, people talk of caribou cycles of the order of 60 years. Who's got caribou data for 60 years? You know, we're barely getting up to that now. We haven't even seen one cycle. So you always say, well, it doesn't look like it. But then you talk to people in the tropics and they say, oh boy, this year there are butterflies all over the place, you know. And say, well, why was that? You know, everything is supposed to be nice and even. But I think we have a shortage of data problem. But that's certainly the conventional wisdom further north. It's certainly, I should also mention, it's not true in hares. You can take hares in southern BC all the way up to Alaska and you get the same cycle. So it's certainly not within a species range. Over an enormous range of latitude, there's no impact there.
If you go even further south, are there any cycles, say, with penguins or
anything? Well, that's another good question. I don't know of any. There's getting to be fairly good data for Antarctica. I don't know of any. That's a good question, though. I don't know of any in Antarctica. Yes?
So you were saying that there's some evidence for really long-term cycles in large mammals. Do you have any real information about that?
No, you know, it's not my field. I can simply tell you what I hear from those sort of people. I don't know what the thinking about this is, but of course, with the problem with all these large mammals is they're so impacted now by human things that if the cycles were there, I mean, there's talk of 200-year cycle in elephants in Africa, for example. Well, you could never study that anymore. There aren't enough elephants left that aren't poached or hunted or protected or whatever. So humans have, I think, impacted those so much.
We'll take two more questions because Dr. Krebs has been very generous.
this. No, they're completely independent cycles, as far as we can tell. Yeah, even at the interface, so there doesn't seem to be any hookup there. You just. The best data on that are lab data. Okay, you can set this up very elegantly in the lab. It's very hard to get these data in the field, and all you can do is make the occasional kind of put things together where you've got a female who you've got radio collared that live next to each other, and you're going out finding them every day, and you're like, this female isn't here where she's supposed to be, she's over here, and then you find these females, this baby's all dead. So it's a lot of inference. The best work are laboratory studies.
I've found this a fascinating evening, of course slightly prejudiced because my first degree was in biology. I'll now ask Dr. Chitty to express the wishes of the group. Dr. Chitty.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's exactly 40 years since I first met Charles Krebs. He was then a lowly graduate student who knew absolutely nothing about cycles. In those far-off days, my own knowledge was fairly up-to-date, so it would be mathematically correct to say that I knew infinitely more than he did at the start. But that situation changed very rapidly. For his PhD study, he did a brilliant study of lemmings in the at Baker Lake, which is just west of the west coast of Hudson's Bay. And that study has never been bettered. Then he went on to studies at Berkeley and Indiana, and then back again here, and studied voles in the lower mainland. So now the balance has shifted very much, and his knowledge is almost infinitely greater than mine. I still have a little bit of knowledge, so he can never be infinitely more knowledgeable than I. But I'd like to say that it's been a great pleasure to have been associated with him all these years. And although we agree on the facts about these cycles, we disagree quite often about the interpretation. And I'd like to say that although as supervisors we like to think that we teach our students, or at least encourage our students to think for themselves, when they start disagreeing with their supervisor, that's carrying things a little bit too far. But compensation for that is something which I think is well expressed by somebody called Zinsser, and I copied out the quotation that seems to me quite appropriate to the situation between Charles Krebs and myself. As we grow older, which I'm doing at a rapid rate, in a rapidly advancing science, or even in a slowly advancing one like ecology, our task is to retain the capacity of joy in discoveries which correct older ideas, and to learn from our students. That is the only sound prophylaxis against the dodo disease of middle age. Well, I'm getting to be quite a dodo, and it's very nice to know that Charles Krebs is carrying the torch so successfully, as you've heard tonight. Thank you, Charles. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
The tickets will be available down at the desk here for the Kook concert. Those of you who'd